The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. On Memorial Day 2011, a day in which we honor those who have served and still serve in the military, a group that some of you know I have a lot of interest in because they are not only protecting our freedom, they're being subjected to one of the greatest drug assaults in the history of the world. It's now estimated that 20% of our active duty soldiers are on psychiatric drugs. And when they come home so inevitably suffering from the ravages of war, which we call PTSD, the PTSD being the reaction of a normal person with a normal brain to extraordinary circumstances, well, when they come home, they're given even more drugs. So In memory of those who served and still continue to serve, let's do our best to protect them from this latest abuse of the psychopharmaceutical complex. This Memorial Day weekend, I've been to two outdoor celebrations with much too much food, and two themes abound as I chat with people. One is, I think at least half our population is on psychiatric drugs. Sit down in a group of four folks, and two of them, when they learn who I am, will start talking with me about being on psychiatric drugs. And most of them, and here's a change, will begin to talk about how it's too much psychiatric drugs. Including a professional I met for the first time, a wonderful woman from the University of New Hampshire, who is a professor there. You'll get to meet her more, and I'll get to tell you more about her because she's going to be on the show in September, I think. And including a social worker who's working at a local facility for completely out of control kids, kind of a jail for kids, but fancied up. And she's talking about the psychiatrist there being appalled by how many drugs the kids are on when they come in. So I think America may be reaching a saturation point for psychiatric drugs, and also that I think there's a changing tone, a changing attitude, as people are beginning to see this as foolhardy and dangerous. My guest today is my friend Ty Colbert, C-O-L-B-E-R-T, Ph.D., a clinical psychologist. He's been doing that for 30 years, and he specializes in, bless him, psychotherapy free of psychiatric drugs. And in doing so, he's willing to work with people who are given the worst labels, schizophrenia, bipolar, and he also cares a lot about kids and has worked with a lot of children labeled ADHD. He's the author of Broken Brains or Wounded Hearts, What Causes Mental Illness. Another is Rape of the Soul, and another Blaming Our Genes, and as he puts it, as well as a few short booklets. You can find all of his stuff on Amazon.com. He gives continuing educational seminars around the United States, talking about the fallacies of the medical model. mental illness approach and advocating drug-free psychotherapy. If he sounds like my brother, he feels like my brother, my good brother. He works now in a prison as a psychologist in the state of California. Now, Ty gave a presentation toward the end of our conference on Sunday, and he talked in the most amazing way about empathy under the most extraordinary circumstances. So I thought it would be a good idea to start out with that today. My brother Ty Colbert, you there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
I want to tell you that I realized I didn't have a landline in my house and that my cell phone doesn't work well, so I had to drive a half an hour to find somebody with a landline.
Well, I'm glad you made it.
I did.
I'm glad you... It sounds like life with Ty Colbert. Ty, you gave some of the most memorable vignettes I've ever heard, and some of the most empathic descriptions of working with horribly violent people in the prisons. Is that enough to just for you to pick up on and talk a little with
sure.
any other introduction you want to make?
Yeah, no problem. When I went to work for the prison system, I guess about 6 years ago, and actually I was just going to do it part-time, and then I sort of fell in love with it. But the first place I worked at was a level four prison in the state of California. There's four levels, level four being the highest level. And the first day I walked out there, the supervising psychologist said, "Well, I'm taking you to a special place." He said, and he went and explained there's four levels in the California system, but this is a level, it's above the fourth level. And it was
that's
a place where they kept the most severely mentally ill and the
most
violent.
Explain to people what levels are, security, levels of security for the most violent people.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways they're you know, they're sort of caged up like Silence of the Lambs. They don't wear a mask and such, but they all are in cells with... they're normal cells, but the whole front is plexiglass versus normally being a door with a window. They're all plexiglass so that the officers can see in on them at any time. And any time that they're ever allowed out of the cell to take a shower, or they, 1 hour a day, they get to go out for some recreation in a cage outside. They're handcuffed up and escorted by two officers that wear protective shields on their faces and some other protective gear. So and then interesting enough, when we go to counsel them, they're brought down into a probably like about a 3 foot by 3 foot perforated steel wire cage, and they're put in there on a metal seat and locked in there, and then I pull my chair up and do counseling through this perforated wire metal. And then I was assigned eight inmates, and we do group therapy twice a week, and they have eight of these little 3 by 3 foot cages in a semicircle, and all the inmates are brought down one by one, put in there, and then I sit in the center and attempt to do group therapy.
So, and you're not making this up. This is real.
Yes.
Okay. I just want folks to know that. I know it's real. It sounds surrealistic. Sounds
well,
like something out of a bizarre
it really
opening
foreign.
Of a film.
I mean, the first day the supervisor asked me, I said, are you going to come back tomorrow? Because I guess a lot of psychologists don't come back after the first day. So it's a... It's a shock. It wasn't so much a shock in terms of their behavior as much as just how they're treated and how they're caged up.
And what do you talk about?
Well...
And what do you do on an opening session? You've got six men in these little cages and you're there. You're not in a cage then, are you? You're separate at a chair in the middle?
Yeah, they're in a semicircle. Well, if it's one-on-one, then they're in a cage, and then I'm outside the cage, and I can pull my chair up as close as I want or as far away. And I'm supposed to wear a mask in case they decide to want to spit on you to protect me. I never did. And then, when they're in a semicircle, you sit right in the middle, and your head goes back and forth. To tell you the truth, there really isn't. There's probably, as far as the group therapy goes, there's probably very little therapy that goes on. Most of the guys are in such a wild state. I mean, they might start screaming and spitting on the person next to them, or even pulling down their pants and trying to pee on the guy, or yelling and screaming to other people in the facility. It's pretty much a madhouse. Really, sometimes they're just given newspapers to read as current events, and other times some of the other psychologists will pull up a TV and just have them watch TV for the group therapy session. So it was pretty darn non-productive at first. I was able to do some things. So once I was able to gain their trust and they knew that I was there for them, then they were starting to open up, and we did start to do some therapy.
Can you give us any flavor of that, what that was like? Are you still doing that particular kind of setting?
No, I left that prison, and now I'm at a prison closer to home. That was quite a ways away, a prison which is a low-level prison. But I miss those guys, tell you the truth.
Can you give a sense of when you actually thought maybe you had gained some trust and you were helping a person, what in the world that looked like in that context?
Well, most of these guys have been so severely abused, and when they were young, and no real relationships with any parents. Let me just back up a second. The psychologists there would go down there, and they had their own office. We had a kind of a group office outside the one facility, because the inside of the facility, it smelled pretty bad, because there probably wasn't a week that didn't go by that they had to pepper spray somebody in there. So it was hard being in there odor-wise and such. But the other psychologists would go down there, and as soon as they could, they would leave, and they just did the minimum amount. I started staying afterwards, if I had to walk back with a psychologist to have kind of a meeting, after they went, they'd go over and take a two-hour lunch. I would go back down there by myself and hang out, or I'd stay after they left. And that in and by itself made a huge difference in the MA. So they realized that I really wanted to be there for them. And I'll tell you, that one move alone probably did more to create a therapeutic alliance than anything. I did other things like... every day I'd bring the newspaper, the sports page in, and I'd cut it and paste it onto an 8.5 by 11 sheet, double-sided, and run off copies, and then go down and give them each a copy so they had some kind of contact with the outside world. And then I'd bring them in books if they wanted a Bible or a dictionary. It's amazing how many of them wanted a dictionary. I'd bring in, I'd go out and buy one at the bookstore and bring it in. So just doing little things like that. At first I was really tested in there. They don't trust anybody in there. And then doing things like that, the trust level just went right up through the ceiling. Being one of the least effective ones at first because I was new, at the end I was by far the most effective one, and any of the most difficult ones they assigned to me. Just from the rapport and the trust that was built. But once that trust was built, and again, this is psychotherapy 101, isn't it? Once the trust was built, then they would really start to open up, and you could just feel the bond between them, and it was really an enriching experience for me as well. I mean, there were just a couple really scary guys in there that, I'd feel okay about going inside the cell with them and sitting there and hanging out. And if they would have allowed me, I would have gone in there and hung out with them just so that they knew that I wasn't afraid of them, and that I trusted them that far. So And it's amazing how their behaviors would diminish just from the trust and the realization I cared for them. So much of their wildness. These guys had no control, for the most part. They had no control over their emotions. They were like I had two grandsons, I think 5 and 7 at the time. And, one of them takes a toy away from the other one. The other one slugs them. They're good grandkids, but you know how they react. They just react spontaneously. They had no control over their emotions. And I kind of felt that these guys were exactly the same way. They were like little kids with absolutely no control of their emotions. But they were men that could hurt people and also had a lot more rage in them and wanting to hurt people. But once again, the changes were significant just from them. Most of these guys, I just don't think have ever had an adult in their life that they could trust, which is real sad. Real sad. I brought one guy a Bible. He must have been in his 30s. I can't remember now. I brought him a Bible, and he started to cry. And I asked him, "Why are you crying?" It was actually his birthday. He said he wanted a Bible for his birthday, so I brought him a Bible and a little cheapy paperback. And he started to cry, and I said, "Why are you crying?" He says, "Nobody's ever given me a present before in my whole life." And I think a lot of those guys had experienced lives like that. So once you got to know them, it was explainable why their behavior was the way it was.
I worked, had a friend for many years who worked with the most violent and hateful criminals, sex abusers and rapists and murderers. And he always said that when you got to know the person and what they've been through, you weren't at all surprised at what they'd done. That, yeah, again, is not to excuse unethical, horrible, or violent behavior, but it does seem usually to have a context of horrible abuse behind it in most cases. Now, in the case of the man that you gave the Bible to, did you ever have exchanges with them that would look anything like therapy, where you would talk about childhood or talk about abuse? Were you able ever to get to that level?
Sure.
What was the deepest you would go?
Oh, yeah. It would get, pretty psychodynamic in some ways. There was one man in there that he would wipe his feces on the walls, and then he had a habit of he was probably the biggest troublemaker in there. He wouldn't flush his toilet, and so it started to stink pretty bad. And then a lot of times when they wanted to get even with the COs, they would block the drain on their toilets and then just start flooding their toilets. And then there was three tiers in there, so especially if they're on the top tier, they would they could flood half the place there before the CLs could get in there and stop it. So he'd trap flies and grow maggots in there, and he did a lot of things with his feces and such. And we got to talking about it, and he said that when he was a little boy that sometimes that he'd have to go to school with dirty pants, and the kids would make fun of him. And then he got to realize that when he spoiled his pants and had to go to school, that if he started chasing them, he ran him off, and that was empowering to him. So even though he realized what he was doing with his thesis, it was still sort of an addictive power thing to him to be able to have a sense of power over the whole place. And the sergeant would literally give him some cigarettes at night to get him to flush his toilet. So, that's a pretty basic example of somebody doing something pretty odd, not understandable, but really understandable once you understand what he went through as a child.
Yeah. Any other examples come to mind of the kinds of conversations you had with people about their lives?
Well, it was interesting to a lot of it, especially some of the ones that were more out of control with their emotions. They were there a lot just because of spontaneous acts of rage. One guy that had some real severe abandonment issues when he was a child. I was married and had a wife and a kid, and a drunk driver happened to run into his wife and his kid and kill him. And went into a rage or whatever and went over to the guy's house. I don't know how he found out about the guy, probably a police report or whatever. Pulled the guy out of his house and did not want to kill him in front of his family, so dragged him off to a park and killed him. And then was convicted both of murder and kidnapping. Another guy in there had walked in. He was a black guy in L.A., and he says, you know, everybody carries a gun in L.A. It's almost a must anymore. Walked in, and some guy was raping his sister, and he just pulled out the gun and just emptied it on the guy. So a lot of guys were in there and just, like my grandkids that would throw a toy at each other, except they'd shoot each other in a pretty spontaneous moment. They just had so much hurt in them and so much loneliness and rage that when it was triggered, they couldn't stop it from coming up. So we would talk a lot about that, and again, a lot of it just the cell with the plexiglass front. There was just, there's a little about a half an inch clearance between the wall and the sliding glass, plexiglass door. I'd pull my chair up and just sit there. And of course, I was instructed to wear a mask so that they wouldn't spit on me or throw their urine at me. But I never felt that risk, and I didn't do it. But I just sit there and talk and actually did a lot more therapy there when everybody else left and the place had calmed down than I ever did in those cages. I can't remember much going on in those cages, because take an inmate out of a cell, and someone sets his home and put him down in a cage right in the middle of where everybody's watching him and everything. There's so much action going on. I don't think they ever calmed down to really talk. There was probably a little bit of talk there, but it was really after the other psychologist left and the place calmed down, and I just pull up a chair and sit there and start talking. And that's where the therapy went on.
So you're sitting talking through a crack that's about 2 inches between
about
the wall
a half inch
and the
crack,
plexiglass?
Just enough room for the door. To sit in front of the plexiglass door and try to talk through a 3/8 half inch plexiglass, there was just too much of a deadening of the sound. So I would move over to the door just slid open and slid closed, and I just would get over to the side where there was a half an inch open space where the door cleared at the wall, and then he'd come over and sit there, and that's where we did all the talking. And like I said, I would have gone inside, but they would have never let me go inside.
Did you do that with several different prisoners, or was there one in particular that you would meet that way?
No, I did it. I did it with one guy that was wiping his feces on the walls, and then I was the only one that could get him to flush his toilet. I did it with a guy with a Bible. There was another guy in there that he had the scariest eyes of anybody in there. Like I mentioned, it was like Charles Manson's eyes, but he could look right through you. But he was my favorite. He would see a green or a red aura around people, and I don't know if he actually saw it or just was a hallucination. I think it was just probably a hallucination. But he could look at somebody for about 5 seconds and tell them whether they were a good guy or a bad guy. And I had a lot of fun with that. And he was the only one that I was the only one that he trusted with that. But we'd get a new CO in there, and he'd look over there and say, "No, Red." And I said, "No, he looks like a pretty good guy." And he'd say, "No, Red." And then I get to know the CO, and I go back and I say, "Yeah, you're right." and then there was only one. There was about eight or nine COs that worked in there, and there was only one guy in there that had a green tone to him, or whatever. And then unfortunately, most of the psychologists he saw red. So, which I don't know what to say about that, but he was a neat guy. I wouldn't have had any qualms. I felt safe enough. I would have taken him home, you know, if my wife would have let me. we had an excellent rapport, and I don't remember about what he talked about in his childhood. I've forgotten now, but he was a neat guy. He felt a real connection with him, and I felt a connection with a lot of them.
Now, Ty, when we act as forensic experts in the courts, one of the issues that comes up a lot is remorse. Did that person feel remorse? And what's your experience with this particular group of men that you've worked with who have been horrendously violent at one point or another and still act really out of it a lot of the time? Do they have any sense of remorse for what they did?
Oh, yeah.
Or did they
feel
justified?
A lot of them
justified?
Were probably overwhelmed with guilt and such. I would go to get the way that this prison is set up. It's divided up into four major areas, and then each major area had about four different housing units. And so I would go through I would go through probably the toughest area to get to my housing unit, and so I would. And there was in the middle there was a recreation yard, so I would go by the most hardened criminals that have come out of this facility. Took the prisoners that came out of Los Angeles County, so I would go by the most hardened prisoners, and they were scary. They looked like they could kill you in a half a second if they wanted to. This is they were out there in a yard, and I was told to not walk out onto their yard at all. And if you hear any gunshots, just lay down on the ground and don't move. And there was warnings on the wall about helicopters overhead and the whole works. It was you feel like it was a war zone, but those guys, they stare you down, and they had a lot of hate. But when I get inside my complex, it was like, I'm telling you, it's like the little kids. It was just like little kids out of control.
What were you saying? I actually talked over you for a brief minute. You were saying that they had a lot of guilt?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of guilt and remorse. Because most of them, a lot of times, you know, they weren't the ones out in the main yard, the ones that you know, plan murderers and involved in drug deals and major drug deals, and if something goes wrong, they just, you know, don't feel any qualms about killing somebody. The ones in my unit are the ones that are more apt to have spontaneously just killed somebody out of a rage or abandonment issues and such. So they were a lot more remorseful than the ones out in the yard, because I didn't get to know the ones out in the main yard, but there was plenty of remorse in them, in the majority of them.
That's a very important distinction, I think, between the people who are sort of corporate murderers, part of the gang, part of the business, versus the people who lost control of themselves.
Yeah, right. And see, the ones that are out in the main yards that are calculating and willing to kill somebody, and it doesn't bother them. They're not the mentally ill ones, in a sense. They're not the ones that are maybe hearing voices to hurt others and stuff. It's just part of their life. I mean, it's just they're hired killers. Not that some of them couldn't be diagnosed as mentally ill and such, but they're pretty rational, and rational might not be the right word, but they're pretty premeditated and rational in what they're doing, where the guys inside my place were much more spontaneous and just acting out of raw emotions.
What was your area called? It sounds like, the place for the criminally insane.
Oh, it's called EOP Ad Sec. Right, it doesn't make any sense to you at all, does it?
No.
When somebody is convicted. When somebody violates a major law inside of the prison system, they're put in where they don't necessarily take them to court and have them convicted of a crime, you know, through a trial and a regular court of law. They're put in what's called administrative segregation. They just can put them where they need to for safety. And so EOP is called enhanced outpatient. It's actually the more severely mentally ill people in there are at an EOP level. So somebody who's nonviolent, not causing any problems, can still be at an EOP level of needing mental health care. So you add the EOP, the ADSEC, you're adding the more severely mentally ill with the more violent that are committing, you know, crimes inside the prison, which might mean they're just splashing, mad and act out and splashing their urine or trying to splash their urine on a correctional officer. Or they just blow up. You know, a lot of them hear voices, too. They're so paranoid because they've been abused so much, and through growing up in abusive families and living in the inner city and doing gang stuff. Hanging around gangs causes a lot of paranoia because you never know who you can trust.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of them hear voices that will tell them to beware and strike out at somebody before they strike out at you. So a lot of them, if a correctional officer comes up to them, they might attack the correctional officer.
I gotcha.
Just out of a defense, because if you think about it, if you have to wait around for wondering when somebody's going to stab you or somebody's going to get you, it drives you nuts. So it's much,
yeah.
It's much more, what word I want to use, relaxing is not the right word, but it's much more right. Easier to be the person that strikes out.
Ty, we're going to take a break for a couple of minutes. You're listening to Ty Colbert, psychologist from California, and this is Peter Bregan.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
In the world.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Progressive Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for all things progressive.
This is Dr. Peter Breggin, and I'm talking with my friend, psychologist Ty Colbert from California. As I'm listening to Ty talk about working with some of certainly the last members of society that we think would respond to empathic therapy or empathic relationship, or hints of empathy that manage to get through to them, it reminds me of such an important principle that I can't overemphasize. Caring relationship, empathic relationship, is not the luxury of the walking wounded who are functioning well in society and then come for high-priced outpatient therapy. Yes, empathic therapy is for them, too, the successful, the wealthy, the high-functioning, and so on. But actually, the more a person has been wrecked by life, the more a person's been wrecked by their own mistakes and bad behavior, the more they've been injured by chance as well as their own irresponsibility. However a person has been damaged, the more crazy acting they are, the more psychotic, to use that word, they are, the more they seem to be someone who'd be labeled schizophrenic, the more that they seem to be lost causes, the more they need empathic, caring help, the more that becomes the starting point. I'm getting dragging noises. Is that, Ty, is that from your end?
I don't think so. What kind of noise?
Like a dragging noise of something being dragged across something.
No, no. Or, I mean, there's a little light wind coming through here, but I don't think that would...
That's what
no
it may
sound
be.
From that. No.
Could be the wind. That's what it sounded like. It sounded like somebody out in the wind. Well, here's Ty Colbert. Again, Ty, I think that...
I'm going to move indoors where it's where there isn't the wind, and you tell me if it goes away.
Okay.
Is it going away?
Well, it's gone. It stopped when you started talking with me.
All right.
But we can handle anything.
You know, if you... I'd like to go back to that issue of remorse, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
The reason I want to go back to it is an important one. Most of my profession, perhaps all of it, feel like that we hear all the time that sociopaths or psychopaths don't have any guilt or shame. And through working with some special clients at certain times, I realize that really isn't true. That's just the opposite. That and to think about the fact that they wouldn't have any guilt or shame would sort of make them, like, not human. That doesn't really make sense either. But they have so much guilt and shame in them that if they ever did let that guilt or shame up, it would destroy them. So what they do is they literally cover all that guilt and shame up with a rage. So what you see from them is sort of a stoic, non-emotional front of anger or non-emotions, and that's the way that they dissociate themselves from the guilt and shame that happens. And quite often when they commit an act, they might feel a tad bit of shame or guilt from their act, but to push that guilt and shame down, they'll turn into anger real, real quick. And you'll hear somebody, you know, a rapist say, well, you know, I raped her because the way she was dressed or so. They have to give themselves some sort of permission to suppress and push that guilt down in order to give themselves permission to act out. But why I'm saying that is that because that just dawned on me the difference between those 2 yards. The one main yard that I go through where those guys are incapable of feeling any guilt or shame because it's so blocked out with their rage, those are the guys that are the scary ones that don't, in a sense, they're not aware of any remorse, even though it's hidden deep down inside of them. Where the guys that are in my group, do have a tremendous amount of guilt and shame for their actions. And that might say why those guys in there are more apt to be, quote, mentally ill than the guys out there in the yard that don't feel any guilt and shame or not aware of it. Is that making some sense?
Yeah. Let me distinguish between guilt and shame, because I think it might be very important here. The way I look at guilt, it's the individual actually feels a certain amount of power, the power to do bad. They've been taught that they're bad, that they hurt their mother, they hurt their father, their existence is a burden on the world, they're to blame for dad's heart attack, they're to blame for mom's breakdown, and so on. So they feel powerful, but bad, and they direct the anger in. And that more traditionally can look like remorse, because the anger and the blame goes in. I think the people you are describing don't quite sound like that. They sound like shame-driven people. And when people feel ashamed, they see the power as coming out them, at them. Women control men. They make us do what we want. I had to kill that guy. He dissed me. He murdered my family or raped my family. I had to do it. I had to do what I was doing. The power is from outside. The individual is driven by shame, which is not a feeling of bad and powerful, but of weak and helpless. So I think the people you're describing, when they're talking, they're probably, it sounds to me like that they're immersed in the shame aspect of life, which is, it's been done to me. I was made small. I was humiliated. I was dissed. I was disrespected. I was taken advantage of. I did what I had to do. That's a really different than guilt. How much do you actually see guilt as I'm describing it, if you go along with the distinction? And how much do you see guilt?
So really quickly, the guilt, because I define it a little bit differently. The guilt is, tell me again real quickly, the guilt is?
Well, when people feel guilty, they feel like they have power. They feel like they have power to hurt their mothers, their fathers, their wives, mm-hmm. their children. They may feel that their existence hurts the world.
All right. I'm probably using guilt. We're using shame and vice versa. Right, but what they're doing in that guilt is they're turning it to a rage. The flip side of guilt is rage.
So, well, I want, but it's usually rage
bad,
itself.
You're flipping
rage,
that over and empowering yourself with the rage.
Well, I think that's more shame. This could be an important conversation. I see that as more shame, that the flip side goes to violence and hate and attack when you feel humiliated. If you look at all the people who've tried to kill and assassinate presidents or...
Okay, now you call that shame, right?
Yeah, because it's coming from a feeling
guilt,
of being humiliated,
guilt is
not being made to feel guilty.
You should feel when you've done something wrong.
Excuse me?
Shame is when other people are attempting to make you feel bad for who you are when you haven't really done anything wrong.
No, that's more like guilt again. I think shame is a very specific feeling where you feel small, out of it, remote, excluded, powerless, and you're tired of being made powerless, being taken advantage of, being manipulated.
You're usually a loner,
you're usually shy,
you
and you
I mean,
strike back with violence. That's more, whereas guilt is more, I'm this horrible person, I ruined my marriage, I ruined my family, I deserve to die. I think they're different. And then the violence goes inward. Make any sense?
Yes, right.
I think most of these people are not directing their violence inward very much, except maybe to cut themselves or deal with...
Those people that I work, because those people that I work with, there's also a lot of self-hate and self-mutilation and such, too.
Yes.
So that would be that what you're calling the guilt turned inward.
Maybe to some extent. I do think there's a fundamental difference when you talk with a human being about whether they're telling you that they are the cause of harm in the world. They hurt their mothers and fathers. They hurt their children. They're hurting the world by breathing. They don't deserve to live. They feel bad. They get horribly depressed, and they hurt themselves. I think it's very different than people who see the danger outside themselves, feel humiliated,
so you're
put down,
about
and
how
strike
that empowers
back.
Them by feeling and believing that way.
I'm sorry, what'd you say, Ty?
You're talking about how that empowers them by believing and feeling that way.
Yes.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
They
okay,
turn
no,
the humiliation
that,
around
because,
into
right.
I'll humiliate you.
But
I'll make you nobody.
Right.
Very different, I think, than what drives guilt. Even if a guilty person gets angry, eventually it's likely to be more directed inward. And they're not likely to be in murderer's row. They're likely to be a suicide, I think. I think there's an important distinction there. And that's why I think maybe you're not actually seeing remorse so much as these people are admitting they're ashamed of themselves, which is deep in itself and maybe even harder than admitting that you feel bad about yourself, to admit you're ashamed, you feel like you're nobody.
With the group that I was working with, inside.
Yes.
Right, right. Okay, right. Yeah, no, I agree with you. They hate themselves. Most of the men there hate themselves.
I am sure that's true. I think it's a hatred, that they were made to feel guilty, but that they were made to feel worthless and nobody.
Right, and that's why me spending the extra time sitting and doing a few extra little things for them, showing them that I care for them, helps to begin to sabotage all that self-hate.
Yeah, well, I think you're giving them basic worth. You're not relieving them of their guilt, which I don't think is the issue. I think you're giving them basic worth that one human being
right,
would spend
right. I'm not
time
letting them
with
off
them.
The hook up for anything, but I'm letting them know that if I care for them, then maybe there is some self-worth there if somebody
yes.
like me cares for them.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I think that they're working on the level of, do I have any worth at all? Not am I bad, but do I have any worth at all, any meaning, any consequence? Am I anybody? Would anybody care about me? And that drives horrible violence, horrible violence.
Right. And you are correct with that. And that probably says a lot to why they're still so out of control, because none of us can handle those kind of emotions for very long without acting out one way or another. I mean, you don't sleep really well with those kind of emotions running
that's
around
right.
inside of you. That's
well,
for
I
sure.
think most anger, even in marriages, ordinary marriages and friendships, most anger is feeling disrespected or not being taken seriously by the other person, in a sense being humiliated by the other person. I think almost most anger is about that awful feeling of being of no consequence. I'm just searching for different words for it. Ty, a lot of these people must be drugged out of their minds with psychiatric drugs. Is that right? And what effect
right.
is it having?
Right. Well, the prison system does. I'm not happy with it, but the prison system does fairly well by not drugging them too much. And the main reason for that is they got their socks sued off a few years ago.
Okay.
So they have to be pretty careful with it. But if they're always up in the dosage and changing the medication, and somebody's too out of control, they're going to take them down and, you know, give them a shot of Aldol. So they don't hesitate, but you don't see, you go into a mental hospital, say mental hospital or somewhere, even in the local psych ward of a regular hospital, you see everybody just sitting around in a stupor. You don't really see that inside the prison system.
At least where you are. And that's
yeah,
because
right.
maybe
now, if they go,
because of the right to refuse drugs.
If they're
drugs.
More serious cases and they go over to the Department of Mental Health, then you'll see them all, you know, drugged up really bad. But
yeah.
And when I say drugged up really bad, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're drugged up really bad, but they're not drugged to the point that they're in a stupor.
Now, would most of these people consider it a punishment to be sent to the mental health facility?
Say that again.
Would most of these people consider it a punishment to be transferred to the mental health facility?
That they're in this one place where I'm at, where I was working.
Yeah, I'm
at.
Saying it's my experience that prisoners would rather be in the most horrendous jails usually than go to mental health facilities where they're drugged heavily.
It's all voluntary. They do not have to take the meds if they don't want to.
Right.
Except for some extreme situations. And most of them that have lived with drugs their whole life and live and die with drugs and don't know how to operate without drugs and don't know how to sleep without drugs or anything like that. I don't think they mind the drugs that much, to tell you the truth. And again, because they're pretty cautious about drugging them up too much.
Right,
so
right.
I think under the horrendous conditions that they live, they don't mind, being drugged up because that's what they've known for most of their life.
I understand. Yeah. Ty, we got about 8 or 9 minutes left. What can you communicate? Maybe some of the lessons or some of what you really learned working with the worst of the worst.
Well, probably more importantly than others, I learned, that these guys were, in some ways, pretty normal guys that could really care for you and wanted just as much of a future as anybody else and certainly has potential, but just were out of control of their emotions due basically to their childhood and what happened to them in there. And the other thing, just hanging out with them. I worked in the inner city of L.A. and worked with gang kids, and the most effective tool I had down there was to hang out with them. So just by hanging out with them, probably did more to developing the kind of trust, and they needed to relax. They were always constantly on guard, in and out of prison their whole life, living in the inner city and having a father or stepfather come home abusive and mad. And so many of them will tell me stories about how their brother is shot and killed in their arms and right in front of them and things like that. So they're not capable of doing any introspection or any therapy unless they can relax around you. So, again, just hanging out with them and being patient and waiting for them to get to the point where they can trust you. And then they start opening up.
Yeah, to one degree or another, that's the start of every good relationship and every therapeutic relationship.
Absolutely.
Is that ability to find a comfort zone between two or more people.
Yeah, upper middle class white boy down in working the streets of L.A., I had to learn to do what was necessary to earn their trust first before I had any effect with them. And so that's the same thing that happens in therapy. And
what's drawn you to working with these?
The more that a person's drugged up, the less you have to do that, right?
Yeah. Ty, what's drawn you to working with people from such a different background than your own?
I'm sorry, say that again. How's that? What?
What's drawn you to this work with such difficult people from such different backgrounds than yourself?
Well, probably because I was a rebellious, rowdy kind of person when I was young.
Okay.
I don't know. I just like
those identify
kind of guys.
With them.
They're just to me, they're more real, and they'll bond with you and trust you a lot more once you develop that relationship. And I don't know, that's just a group that I'm drawn to.
Ty, do you have a private practice where people can call you and come see you?
Not anymore. I once in a while I'll pick somebody up, but right now I have a mother who's in a hospice situation I take care of. And another thing is happening, Peter. My wife's been helping out with a little boy that's for 4.5 years that's got a horrendous life, and so we're in the process of possibly adopting him.
Oh my!
Right.
That's going to be another story.
Yeah, and it will be a story because my wife has just it's just been a miracle worker with him. He's in absolutely no trouble around her. She's got him where the teachers actually love him. But according to the psychologist, the court psychologist that's in charge of the case, he's a bipolar sociopath.
Oh boy,
and he has 3 or 4 psych meds. So, one of our goals is going to be to have to work with a psychiatrist that I haven't met yet and convince him he doesn't need to be on the psych meds. And I might be calling you on some advice on that. Not how to get him off, but so much sounds like more of a challenge than convincing the psychiatrist to let him get off the drugs. But anyway, that's what's new is going on in my life.
Okay. Ty, we're going to be ending now. This is Peter Bregan, and I'm saying goodbye to my friend Ty Colbert. Thank you, Ty. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.